Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, Dave's choice was Brainstorm, a 1983 film in which,
I mean, first and foremost, I think it's important that I say, I am sorry, again.
We haven't had an episode starting with apology for a while, I don't think.
It hasn't been for a little while, yes, but...
So, tell me, why? Why did you pick it?
So... recently, we've had a few things that could be described as serious, pretentious, worthy of deep scholarly reflection. We've had, you know, biblical prose. We've had serious race relations in America. And I thought I'd go for something which I would best describe as zany.
I mean, I don't think I would use that to describe it at all, but okay.
Okay, but yes.
But I mean, what is your previous experience of this film? Because you were like 11 when it came out.
I mean, are we going to talk about that before we let the listeners know anything about the film?
I mean, I can do a brief plot synopsis if you want.
I think we should probably do that first.
Okay.
Because otherwise, you know, context.
The film follows a research team's efforts to perfect a system that directly records and replays the sensory experiences and emotional feelings of a subject, and the efforts by the company's management to exploit the device for military ends. After one of the researchers records her own death from a heart attack, her colleagues join forces to retrieve the information and play it back, because they're all insane.
I mean, that does make it sound both a lot more interesting and... a lot better put together than it actually, you know, is. What is my recollection of the film and why did I choose it? My recollection of the film was mostly that it was about recording, as you say, people's sensoria on tape in a very 1970s kind of way.
Yeah.
And that...
very shiny tape.
Yes. And then towards the end of the film, it gets transcendentally wacky.
For like 30 seconds.
Okay. And that's mostly what I remember is the transcendentally wackiness. And so I thought I would pick it because it was weird. We'd been doing something that was, you know, relatively sensible for a while and I wanted to pick something that was just weird.
Okay.
And this is what, you know, sprang to mind. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. Fair enough. Right. So, yeah, we've already done a plot synopsis, so we're a little bit out of order, I guess. But what was your overall takeaway from this? Oh, God, the face. This experience?
The fuck? Was pretty much what I wrote down, with many U's.
Okay.
And quite a few, you know, ellipses and a question mark.
Right.
How about you? Did it hold up for you overall? What, hence the apology? What is going on there?
So there's nothing necessarily wrong with the overall plot beats that they're trying to do. It's just kind of batshit. It's not very well written. There's some weird comedy moments towards the end that don't make any sense.
Yes, it did get a bit Benny Hill towards the end.
Yeah.
For bizarre reasons.
It goes, you know, there's the weirdly transcendental bit at the end, which is quite questionable. But there's also the fact that there are absolutely no, what's the word I'm after? Likeable. I don't know if likeable is the right word. There's no good characters. All the characters are, you know, bag of dicks, basically, at the end of the day.
Pretty much. I actually found it really hard to follow as well, but I will come
to
that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't find it.
It was very confusing.
I mean, I didn't find that, but, you know, none of the characters are particularly likeable. The main plot is arranged around this machine they're inventing, and how they interact with it and what it is capable of is wildly random during the film.
Yes, it does seem to be the way, yes.
It does change a lot.
Very little is actually explained.
And there's almost no plot.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So, you know, as a science fiction concept movie, of which there are a lot of, you know, slightly questionable, high, what's the word I'm after, concept science fiction movies in the sort of 70s and 80s, you know, you could do Solid Green, or you could do the Murder Ball one, I can't remember the name.
Okay.
But there's a lot of these kind of things, and I, you know, really like those kind of films.
Yeah.
And this is you know, hardly any of them are actually good, but I like the concepts.
Yeah.
And again, this has got a lot of really good concepts in. It's just kind of, well, we'll talk about, when we get to the facts, we'll talk about the money thing, but it, you know, it kind of looks like it's made on a shoestring and has a lot of, you know, Christopher Walken gurning in it a lot, so what's
true.
Not, what's not to like?
Okay, well, do we want to go with facts?
What do you have?
I mean, largely that the whole production was overshadowed by the fact that Natalie Wood, who played Karen, one of the main characters, died in mysterious circumstances towards the end of production. There was an awful lot of controversy about that went on for a very long time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, decades.
Oh, wow.
The case was actually reopened in 2013, I think.
Really?
Yeah, and wow. One of the people who was interviewed at the time admitted that he lied to the police back in the day and gave new information.
I didn't see any of this at all.
And then it was ruled as much more suspicious circumstances than had previously been thought.
Because the only thing that I know that's on the Wikipedia page is that she was on a yacht with Christopher Walken.
Yes.
And somebody else.
Yeah, and her husband, I think, or her partner at the time.
Okay. And the story is that they woke up in the morning and went to go and look for her, and she wasn't on the boat, and then they found her later. Drowned in the water.
Yeah, but there was a whole thing about people hearing someone screaming for help, unexplained bruises on her body.
Wow.
Things to do with her relationship with the other guy, and her sister saying that she would never have left the boat on her own in the dinghy because she couldn't swim. Mm. There was a whole load of stuff, but it was never determined that you know, there was foul play, but there was an awful lot of controversy, and as I said, when it was reopened, there was a lot more suspicion laid on the other guy. Christopher Walken was never under suspicion for anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that kind of overshadowed a lot of it. And the director saying that Hollywood was an absolute shit show and he never wanted to work again, mostly, it turned out in later interviews, due to this thing that happened with Natalie Wood dying,
actually
left the business for over 30 years.
See, that's really interesting because, again, on the Wikipedia page, it says that the reason why he said, I've had enough of this and left the industry for a really long time was because of the amount of grief that he got because of the amount of money that this film lost, because this film lost a lot of money.
Well, I think there were probably quite a lot of factors, but yeah, he said later that the you know, the death had a lot to do with it as well.
I would imagine. So can I do some
yes,
other bits?
Absolutely.
So let's start off with some context. It's released in 1983. So 1983 is Return of the Jedi. So that gives us an idea of what's around. It's War Games. And it's also The Dead Zone, which we did not very long ago, which is the other, also with Christopher Walken, film that we reviewed recently. So he banged out both of these in the same year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, production schedules mean that things might, you know, not be shot at the same time and then still come out at the same time, depending on the
yes.
schedules.
That's,
wasn't filming them at the same time.
That's a really good point. Actually.
But yes,
yeah.
for obviously close succession.
Obviously, he's in the zeitgeist at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who directed it, who we've already mentioned, Douglas Trumbull, is mostly known for being a professional special effects guy. And, and there'll be a bunch of stuff about special effects that I'll talk about later. He was best known for doing complicated special effects in 2001, Close Encounters, the original Star Trek film, and Blade Runner.
Okay.
So he's got a really good credential. He only actually directed two feature films, this and Silent Running.
Oh.
Which we did for episode 9 of this podcast.
We did. Oh, those poor robots.
Those poor robots. So that's the other thing that he directed.
Okay.
The screenplay was written by two guys who were never heard of before or since.
Oh, okay.
Never wrote anything before, never wrote anything since.
But, that's weird.
But the story, as opposed to the screenplay,
yeah.
The story was written by a guy who was very into transcendental wackiness called Bruce Rubin. And his two main things that he's known for doing are Jacob's Ladder.
Okay.
Which, have you seen?
Vaguely familiar with it, but I don't think I've seen it, no.
It's a film about trauma, the watching of which gives you trauma.
Okay.
I remember being quite shaken up by watching it a long, long, like 30-odd years ago.
Okay.
I have no desire to watch it again. And also, Ghost.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that one. The Patrick Swayze one.
Wow, okay. Well, he's obviously quite keen on, you know, figuring out what happens when you die.
Apparently, because Jacob's Ladder, I think, is also about that, if I remember correctly.
Okay, well, you know, it's a universal theme, I guess.
Indeed. We mentioned Christopher Walken, Natalie Wood, that we've also mentioned. I feel very bad because I'd never heard of her until I read about her on the Wikipedia page for this. And she was apparently in Miracle on 34th Street, Rebel Without a Cause, The Searchers, West Side Story, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So
yeah,
she
I was aware of her name, but I wouldn't have been able to
so list she was a big
credits,
deal.
But I've seen most of those.
Yeah, so she was a big deal at the time. Mm-hmm. Because she died after the major scenes that she was in were filmed,
yeah.
But before they'd finished editing it all together, the studio, I think it was MGM, basically wanted to can the film and pretend it never happened.
Right.
The insurance company, however, was looking at the amount of money that they would have to pay out because of the film being cancelled. Absolutely did not want to pay out that amount of money and gave the director an extra $2.75 million to complete extra principal photography and $3.5 million to do post-production.
Wow.
Was just given directly, effectively, to his company by the insurance company. That allowed him to put the film together well enough to convince MGM to then go and do a release.
Mm.
It's notable that Natalie Wood's younger sister, Lana, comes in and does some pickup shots.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, after she died. None of the major scenes, no to-camera stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, being in the room...
Well, I mean, it does kind of explain certain aspects of it that I really struggled with, because it feels like it's cut together in a very odd way.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, and as I said, I found it very difficult to follow.
No, I didn't feel that, but
yeah.
Okay.
Well,
I can
expound.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good.
Once you're done.
But he, having convinced MGM to release it, the eventual production budget was $18 million, which, I don't know what that would be in today's money, but it only made $10 million in the box office. So the insurance company, having given them a load of money, it still crashed anyway, but at least from the insurance company's point of view, because it was released, they didn't have to pay out.
Mm.
So it was still cheaper for them, even though they gave them, $7 million or whatever it was. It's got about 55% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's a bit of a cult classic, but, not in a big way.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'd never heard of it.
No. Well, it's, as I say, it's in with Rollerball. That's the name of the film I was trying to remember earlier.
Okay.
So it's in with, Rollerball and Soylent Green, and there's a whole bunch of other similar 70s cerebral sci-fi.
Yeah. Most of which I have heard of, and some of which I have seen.
Mm-hmm.
But this one obviously hasn't, had any staying power in terms of the zeitgeist, because I was not aware of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Shall I carry on?
With what? Are you done with facts?
I'm done with facts, yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to talk about my struggles.
Oh.
Because normally it's you that, struggles with identifying characters and knowing who is who and naming and stuff and figuring out what's going on. But I really had some trouble because... It opens with them testing out the machine.
Well, But it actually opens with incredibly wibbly opening credits.
Oh, okay.
Because the opening credits are all kind of this big staticky background and really weird bendy text and kind of really over-the-top music. So you get an idea of it being kind of weird before, you actually ever see anybody on screen.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, so you have this kind of like introductory scene, and it you kind of get, there's an awful lot of showing and very little telling, which normally from a writing point of view, people would think was a good thing, but you need some telling. And there is no telling, pretty much no telling in this film at all.
Mm-hmm.
So after the experiment that they're doing with the machine.
So, really? The important thing is in the first scene, what you get is you get Christopher Walken plugged into the machine doing an incredibly good a la Dead Zone, slack-faced, you know, I'm having a moment kind of thing.
Yes.
While somebody else is wandering around with a camera plugged into their brain. And whatever that person is experiencing, Christopher Walken's having it piped into his brain through the machine. So what you see at the start of the film is what is being sent to Christopher Walken. So there's an awful lot of these shots are through wide-angle lenses, and they're shot from a weird angle, and, you know, the lighting gets weird and stuff because it's supposed to be indicating that you are experiencing somebody's sensorium being piped to you through the machine. And they do that by doing weird, wacky directing stuff.
Okay, this was not my point.
Sorry.
So he eventually goes home to his house where his wife and son are.
Yes.
The following day, he goes into a meeting about extra funding and different development. And there's a woman in the office who the guy who's giving the funding has previously said needs to help with making everything smaller and making it more palatable to investors and whatever. And then he says, is it going to be okay you working with Michael? And she says, yes, that's fine with me. And then they have a meeting. And when Michael stays behind to have a bit of a chat with this guy, he says, is it going to be okay that you're working with Karen? And Michael says, yes.
Michael is Christopher Walken.
Yes.
Right, okay.
It's no problem with me. Yes. And I was like, obviously, there's some weird kind of interesting background between these two characters.
Yeah.
Not realising that it was actually his wife who had already been in it.
Yes.
And that they were going through a divorce, which hadn't been made obvious at all at any point in any way.
In fact, it's never...
And I didn't realise that they were the same person for quite some time.
In fact, it's never...
And I was so confused.
It's never explicitly mentioned.
No.
In fact, there's a really weird bit at one point where she says to him something about, you should go and sleep at the lab, that's where...
Yes, a couple of people come round to look around the house, and someone's showing them the house as if they're selling it.
Yes.
And he goes, oh, I don't have time for this, and she says, it's okay, you go and live at the centre, and I'll pack everything up. But they're perfectly cordial with each other.
But he also said... But, sorry, his current, presumably at some point, due to be ex-wife, says, you can go back to the lab, that's where... What's her name?
Lillian
is. Now, I don't know if that means because, you know, the two of you are working on this incredibly world-changing machine, or if there's supposed to be in the plot originally some kind of implication that he's left his wife to go and be with
Lillian. And he does kiss Lillian.
Yes, and this is the thing. Yeah.
And at the kind of like the polo party, Karen's there with someone else that Michael makes a snarky comment about.
Who is never seen again.
And when Michael then makes a reel for Karen with the machine of all of his like memories of their relationship, and she experiences it from his point of view, they suddenly start having rampant sex and being all smoochy and together again.
And everything is reconciled.
And then this other guy and them having sold the house is never mentioned again. So. Yeah. I was very confused, and I found it very hard to follow.
So the edit, so it feels like a lot has been lost in the edit.
Yeah.
Since we are...
Or a lack of principal photography that presumably needed to involve Natalie Wood, perhaps, that gave the background to their relationship or even the current status of their relationship.
Well, you know, all I can tell you is that the Wikipedia page says that all the principal photography and dialogue was done before she died.
Okay, but anyway.
But since we are in a very normal and typical way for us jumping around quite a lot, there's one thing I just want to slide in at this point.
Yeah.
Because it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that after they have been reconciled,
yes,
the following morning they are lying, both of them naked, in a bed with just a sheet over them.
Yeah.
And their son wanders in,
who's about, I don't know, 12?
12, yeah. Yeah. And says, oh, Dad, you know, I knew you couldn't stay away from the two of us, and seems completely unbothered by his parents with the naked cuddling. And most...
Who like, then start canoodling again
do
before
they?
He's even really out of the room.
I was too busy going, your average 12-year-old would open the door and go, no! And just be, you know, straight out of there at this point.
Yeah. Anyway, so yes.
Yeah, that was weird.
There were other things later on that I was confused by, but they were much, much later on. Oh, okay. It's not related to the relationship.
Shall I throw some random stuff in and then...
Go for it.
We can go to that.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that I want to talk about is actually to go back and say that this is a really interesting concept, which I don't know whether it's been done previous to this, almost certainly in written form.
Although I can't. It's a very common trope.
I mean, it is now, but okay. I don't know.
Well, there's another film, a sci-fi film that's set much later in the future that you made me watch one time that was quite good, that was all to do with some kind of recording of people's experiences. And isn't that kind of basically the entire premise of Total Recall?
No. So Total Recall is connected, kind of similar. But the film that you're thinking of is Strange Days.
Yes.
Which is Catherine Bigelow. I can't remember what year it came out. It was, for a long time, for over 10 years, it was my favourite film. I love that film. It's so good. And also, Black Mirror, a few years ago, did an episode called The Entire History of You, which was about people who have implants in their brain that record all of their memories. And instead of functioning in the real world, people just spend their time reliving all of their best memories in the past.
Right.
And it makes them less and less able to function in the present.
Yeah.
And it's a really good episode. So it's an interesting concept. I don't know whether it had been done on film before. This might have been the first stab that people had at it.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know if it's the, you know, 1970s, 80s science fiction trope, but in a lot of ways, apart from the weird wackiness towards the end, and also I guess maybe just for the sort of first half, it almost kind of felt like a documentary. There are people wandering around filming what's going on in this laboratory where they create this new technology. And so it almost felt like detached from being fictional, which was quite remote. Although at the same time, you've got the co-inventor of the technology, Lillian,
yes. Lillian,
who there's a very brief kind of subplot about how the military are going to take over to use the technology to try and brainwash people and she's very kind of, you know, shouty at the military, and you know, there's a whole another thing that doesn't really go anywhere.
Yes.
So between that and between Christopher Walken's relationship, there are some attempts to make it feel like it actually has a plot.
Yeah.
But not.
Yeah, really? It kind of like shifts around a lot because Lillian finds out about the military involvement and gets really annoyed about it. And Michael does discover later on that that has been happening in the background and that things have been developed, but it never goes anywhere.
No, it never goes anywhere at all.
It gets derailed by this whole thing with the recording of Lillian's death.
Yes.
And I'm like, if you're in the middle of having a heart attack,
yeah, I think we'll...
Would you really decide to travel all the way across your lab and plug yourself into the machine to record it for posterity? I mean, maybe if you're her, I don't know.
I mean, do we want to do that now? I mean, since you brought that up, but...
Worst heart attack acting ever? Although the actress did, in fact, get Best Actress awards. Not at the Oscars, obviously, but at some science fiction awards. And she's barely in it, but anyway... Yes, and I thought she was dreadful, but that's just me.
I mean, yeah, she's pretty bad. Gosh, I wonder what awards those were. I wonder what she was up against.
Saturn Awards?
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big deal in a small pond, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But, yes. Oh, no. Well, first of all, there's Chekhov's heart condition, which is mentioned like 20 minutes earlier.
She looks a bit peaky a couple of times, and people go, are you okay? And she says, yes, this whole thing is making me very upset.
And then takes a pill,
exactly.
But she starts having a heart attack. She's in the lab on her own. She goes to take her pills. She's like, ugh, and she drops the pills on the floor.
Yeah. She tries to call someone and is unable to do so.
Yes.
And then manages to wheel herself halfway across the lab, plug herself into the machine, and start recording.
Yes. You would have thought somehow getting other help and or trying to pick up your pills off the floor would be
a bigger priority.
But
who knows? I mean, it had been established that she was a workaholic and completely obsessed with the project. So maybe she decided that this was it, then that was the main...
I mean, there was also a thing in my mind that she was so frustrated and overwrought with her entire life's work being taken over by the military for nefarious purposes that she might just decide that she's just gonna check out and screw it, you know.
What do you mean?
She's just gonna let herself die rather than see the machine being used for, you know, evil.
Mm.
So that's weird. There was also this weird thing where in every scene she was smoking basically all the time.
Yes.
And none of the other characters.
No, she smoked constantly.
And she was just
doing
it all the
time. I wrote that
down.
It was like she was one of the first people you see, and she's like in charge at the control panel, and she's monitoring everything. And she's smoking you like ash in the computer electronics.
Yes.
Wouldn't be a thing. But anyway.
Well, people probably did smoke in labs quite a lot, but.
Yeah, but she is constantly lit cigarette in hand.
Yes. So,
but perhaps that was meant to denote why she had a heart condition. Who knows?
I mean, who knows? So they're in the center, and it's never really explained. There's some guy who is in charge, and he's the person who's, you know, bringing in the military and bringing in people from other places to come and take over the thing. And there's this wonderful / terrible notion that if, what's his name?
Michael?
Because, you know, it's just Christopher Walken in my head.
Yeah.
That if Michael and or Lillian decide to flounce off and leave, that nobody will ever be able to understand how the machine works because they've deliberately written all their notes in a really terrible, unstructured way that nobody can follow.
Yeah.
And nobody ever do the thing, which, you know, the reality is that nobody is replaceable. You can fire anybody from anything at any point in time and slot somebody else in to go and finish their work. So that's all kind of bonkers. I thought there were some amusing indications that we are living in the future.
How so?
Mostly the architecture.
Okay.
So the architecture of the building that they work in and also his house.
Well, there was a whole thing when the people were being shown round that he had built it himself and made weird modifications, and there were secret tunnels and various things and an indoor swimming pool and stuff.
But it also really reminded me of some shots in 2010, the sequel to 2001.
Okay.
In which, again, the director has gone off and found some interesting and funky buildings which exist in the present day, which aren't real. They did, actually did a very similar thing in Westworld in the TV series, where they went off and found a bunch of buildings that are real but have been designed by architects to look kind of like retro-futuristic, what the future might have looked like. And so there's a whole bunch of we are living in the future. And then also one of my favourite moments in the film is very near the start where Michael is leaving the laboratory and he has a funky bike.
Yeah, well, those kind of bikes do exist.
It's one of those ones
where you kind of like lie
horizontally.
Horizontally,
yeah,
on your
back.
That.
They do, but they're very rare. But it's one of those things that in the early 1980s, you could have assumed, you know, everybody would do
would
that.
Would be
to,
futuristic.
Do in the future.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
yeah,
just
yeah.
a thing to try and show mm-hmm. doing that. There's a bunch of stuff that the director, possibly because of his like special effects background and stuff, has done in a kind of I'm going to go and film a bunch of interesting things in interesting places and then somehow connive them to be in the film. So he goes and films a flight simulation chamber where somebody gets stuck in a big machine that's spun around quite a lot. He films some people in a barometric pressure chamber, which there's absolutely no reason why they would have that at all. There's a bunch of robots building stuff at one point in time. And that's
on the production line.
Yes, and that's you know kind of irrelevant. So he obviously likes that kind of stuff, and again, just wanted to show it off, and also you know look science and technology and future stuff. So he's just gone and filmed a bunch of random stuff. So that's kind of weird. But, yeah, the way that I've got my notes set up is I've got some stuff about the characters. I've got some stuff specifically about the machine. And I've got some random bits and pieces.
Okay.
So, well,
maybe you can help me with the other bit that confused me.
Mm.
So, at one point, about halfway through, Karen and Michael are back together again after, you know, sharing their experiences that they've recorded from their brains. And I think, well, a side note, I think sharing people's emotions and experiences would lead to utter doom rather than suddenly being massively in love with each other again. But that's perhaps just me.
So, briefly, in I can't remember which one, but one of the William Gibson Neuromancer series of books, one of the characters, I think it's Sally, blah, 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 I can't remember her last name, it's one of the main protagonist characters, and she's slept with some guy, and afterwards he says, you know, we've done that, but I thought, you know, if we wanted to be even more intimate, we could share our memories, because all these people have got like brain implants, and we can so see what each other experience being each other, and she's like, get the hell away from me.
Well, yes, quite.
So,
because when they just do like a random few seconds of Karen's thoughts and Michael then plays them back to himself, he immediately gets incredible rage towards himself because she's thinking about how he ignores her all the time.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, anyway.
He when they're playing stuff from him in the past, he's occasionally, you know, lovely and romantic, but he's mostly a terrible, terrible human being.
Yes.
The thing I would just say about the machine is that it starts off real-time playback. You can experience what other people are doing.
Mm.
And there's this wryly amusing bit at the start where they get a bunch of investors, basically, and stick them in a room, and then they play into their brains over the phone line, because that's how you can, you know, play all of these like real-time brain simulation stuff. Recordings, not simulations. But, and then the director has gone off and filmed a whole bunch of things, like being on a roller coaster.
Or riding a horse.
And being on a truck that goes over a cliff edge.
Yes! Yes, that's a good point. Who recorded that?
Who recorded that? And more importantly, in real life, when the director filmed that, we're talking like 20 or 30 years before drones. How did they film that?
That's a good point. I didn't think of that.
So there's a lot of shots in this that must have been done from a helicopter and some very clever camera work.
It also doesn't make sense because a lot of the stuff that's shown that's meant to be from someone's point of view has them in it.
This is exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
So the problem with the machine is it starts off being real time. The very start of the film is they stick a camera on somebody, not a camera, a brain recording device on somebody, and send them off to go and watch some things and listen to some things and eat some things so they can test all the sensories being piped through to Christopher Walken. And then later on, you start to get experiencing other people's memories.
Yes.
And then you start to get, there's some really weird bits dropped in the middle where they're talking about using the machine to gain other people's skills. And I think there's a bit where suddenly,
yeah, he said something to his son about you'd be able to pass the seventh grade in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And but there's like, also and playing the piano and
that
stuff.
Was the other thing. There's a bit where Christopher Walken could suddenly play the piano.
Suddenly like The Matrix. I know Kung Fu.
So there's that. But then also, you start off by getting the memories from the other person's point of view, but then you start to get memories from an external point of view where you're watching two people.
Yes.
Now, whether that's a directorial choice...
Well, it must be.
Or whether it's, you know, suddenly we are seeing things from the outside. It's
again, it
wildly inconsistent how the machine works.
Yes. Anyway, back to my point. They get a phone call from the wife of one of the people who's working on the project, and they zoom round to his house, and he's in his den, in his Lazy Boy, twitching, because he's experiencing a sex tape that's been recorded.
So,
and then after that, he has to go through a whole load of physical tests, and then he gets let go from the project and given a whole load of money so that he can go and play golf forever. And I was like, what? How was that progression of events, did that come about? Because that suggested that it was somehow the company's fault that he'd been given this sex tape and had some kind of adverse reaction to it, but he also then seemed completely fine. So I was, again, very confused.
So there's several things going on here. So the first thing is, which is highly amusing to me...
And his wife didn't seem bothered, also.
So the, So the first thing, which is highly amusing to me, is that they've created an absolutely world-changing device.
Mm-hmm.
You could make an argument almost that you could see this as being a prequel to Strange Days.
Yeah.
Because in Strange Days, the machine is... You can just buy it off the shelf.
Yeah.
There's like consumer versions, but it's never explained where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So you could almost say that, you know, this then leads into Strange Days as a thing, apart from the wibbly transcendence at the end. But so on the one hand, amazing machine. On the other hand, when they get the tapes, they cut and fix the tapes together in exactly the same way they were cutting and editing film at the time this was made. So they lie this... you know, 8-track sized, you know, really shiny tape, and then they effectively cut it with a razor blade and stick it back together with sellotape.
Yes. I do think that was very amusing.
And I thought that was it's like, you know, you see these films that have incredible robots and technology and then everything's saved on floppy disk, or, you know. So, but yes, he creates an endless loop, a tape that loops back on itself of...
Who does?
The guy who you're just talking about.
How?
I don't know the names. Okay. But so he creates this tape.
No, he didn't create it. Gordy created it. Gordy was the one who created the sex tape.
Well, no, Gordy.
Test pilot guy.
Yeah, test pilot guy Gordy created the tape by sleeping with presumably his girlfriend and recording it.
Yeah.
But then Hal takes that tape, cuts out just the bit that's them having sex, and then loops it back on itself.
Oh, I did not get that at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So he makes that.
So he's then trapped in this endless
loop. So he then goes and sticks him... One of the other things that's wildly inconsistent about how the machine works is how much you can or can't interact with reality when you're plugged into the machine.
Really?
Because sometimes, especially more towards the end, while Christopher Walken has the machine playing something back into his brain, when he would be experiencing somebody else's sensoria, he's also talking to people and moving around at the same time.
No. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, okay.
Not that I remember, but anyway, okay.
But anyway, yes, so Hal's got this loop and Christopher Walken turns up and rescues him from the machine. If there was any intonation that he was given any money to go away, I thought he'd just been fired.
No, because he talks about it, because they do a whole load of tests on him. And so he seems perfectly fine.
Weirdly, in this, as I said earlier, this barometric chamber for absolutely no reason.
Yeah, but then they do like a stress test on him and he's like on a treadmill and with like electrodes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he says something about them paying him off.
Oh, I missed that completely.
And then he goes off to play golf.
I missed the paying off thing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I was so confused.
Yeah, well, I can understand that. Yes, since we've mentioned Gordy... Gordy is a guy who, at the start of the film, is doing the tests. So he's eating the food, listening to the music, and his brain is being... His experiences are being piped through the machine to Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
And he is a bit of a joker. So, for example, at the start of the film, he takes the feed which is going into Christopher Walken out of the machine that he's doing and plugs it into the machine that's got the...
Chimpanzee.
And, you know, could have killed Walken for doing that.
Yes, and he's also the one who makes the sex tape.
Yes, it's really incredibly unscientific, a lot of how they're doing stuff.
But then having said that, when they're putting together the demo tape for the investors, some of whom are women, one of the things is Gordy going down a water slide with some scantily clad beach babes.
We'll come to the scantily clad women in the diversity section.
And then the last section of it is even more scantily clad hostesses at some kind of gentleman's club.
We're doing it now,
serving up cake. And that's the end of the demo. And when they switch it off, the guy who's doing the demo just goes, "Oh, sorry, ladies."
And yes, I was going to come to that at the end.
And I was like, really?
Yeah, there was... The investors are all sitting there, well, apart from the woman, are all sitting around with, you know, with big smiles. And it's just like, what are you even doing?
It's very 80s.
But this isn't the point. The point is that there's a tape that's recorded by Lillian of when she dies having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part in the film, two-thirds of the way through, when Christopher Walken starts playing the tape back on himself.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, why would you do that?
Why would you do that?
And then second of all... when
and
he
starts experiencing having a heart attack.
So this is an interesting thing about what on earth does the machine do?
Yes.
Because it's like, you know, the throwaway line in The Matrix where, like, you know, what happens to you in The Matrix also happens to you in the real world.
Yeah.
If you die, The Matrix dies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the first time this happens, Christopher Walken starts to have a heart attack. But then
he starts to experience the sensations of having a heart attack.
Mm.
And,
but then later, when the tape is played back, he is no longer having this physical
effect.
Well,
no, because he does a whole thing where he amends it so that the physical sensations aren't getting through anymore.
Oh, really?
Yes, they have a whole conversation about it. And the guy who's watching,
I missed that
the
completely.
FBI guy who's watching and going, oh, he's you know, doing the thing. And whoever he's on the phone to says, plug someone else into it immediately.
Mm.
And he knows that he hasn't done whatever Christopher Walken has done to mitigate that problem. And he plugs Gordy into the same experience and Gordy dies.
This is where I was coming to. Because the thing is that, you know, Gordy is this sort of comic character.
And then they just kill him off.
And they kill him off screen.
Yes.
And they kill him off screen.
Yeah, very harsh.
And it's just, you know, what are you even doing?
Yeah. And then it's tonally, it's so weird because then you've got Michael and Karen are trying to break into the computer to get a hold of a copy of the tape.
So Michael's become obsessed for some reason with wanting to experience what Lillian experienced when she died.
Yes.
And she was already having the, it's my project, it's my lab, no other people are allowed here, military, get out, blah, blah, blah. And she has this whole hissy fit, which, you know, doesn't look good from a gender point of view.
No, I wrote that down.
And then later on, he has a very similar script. It's my tape. It's my project. I can
this
do whatever I want.
Lab.
This
you
is my lab.
You can't lock me out of my lab.
Blah, 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 blah,
yeah.
blah. And so he's obsessed with watching the tape for reasons that are never
explained,
talked about,
yeah.
or explained in any way. If he just said, you know, I'm really interested in finding out what she experienced, you know, at or after when she died, then, you know, you might have been like, oh, okay, maybe I can understand why you do this. But there's no thing. He's just...
Yeah.
And because he's been kicked out by this point, he and
Karen
are trying to hack into the place to play the tape remotely down the phone to a headset so he can finish
at a point when their son is in an induced coma because he's had a traumatic experience experiencing some random person's psychotic episode by playing with the machine.
So
and they just go, oh, the doctor says he'll be fine, so we're just going to wander off and then go on holiday and then do this caper trying to break into the computer.
So basically what's happened is they discover that the military have been recording people having terrible circumstances so they can attempt to use it to brainwash people.
Yeah.
And the kid, as you say, plugs himself into the machine and plays back this thing. And I'm just basically repeating what you said, but they specifically said, you know, how is our
he's had a psychotic break.
He's had a psychotic break. And they say, will he be okay? And the doctor says, yes, he'll be fine in 2 days.
And they just go, oh, okay, then we'll just disappear off and go somewhere else and do all this other stuff and not mention him ever again.
I'm like, I don't think you get over a psychotic break in 2 days.
Well, also true.
I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah.
But
anyway, and then suddenly they reprogram the robots on this production line and lock all the people out of their offices and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this Benny Hill, lots of foam people, you know, comedy falling down of
robot.
Security guards, robots throwing things at people. Moment.
Robots throwing things through glass,
which would
never be possible and all this kind of thing. And also, as we mentioned to you earlier today, the bit where they're trying to use their security passes to get through these doors and it's all
glass
and they've been locked out and it's like, oh, we can't get in, and then someone just picks up a fire extinguisher and just smashes the large section of glass in the middle of the door and they just walk through it and it's like, do you not think your security design is very good? There's also a really amusing bit where right at the start of this hacking escapade, somebody, I've lost track of who these people are, FBI people maybe, see that Michael has hacked in.
Yes.
And instead of going, oh, well, you know, we can trace where he is and go and get him, or just shut it down, pull the cable out, turn the machines off, whatever. Instead, they say, we should watch him and see what he does.
And they actually get someone to go and find the tape that he's requested and manually plug it into the machine so that he can watch it.
Really?
Yes.
I thought they had a funky robot that put the tape
later
in.
On, the funky robot does it.
Oh, but
that
okay.
time, they get some random schlub in overalls to go and do
but
it.
But it's one of the most stupid things in the film is they've got a bit where they've got a random robot arm that just takes tapes off the shelf and puts it into the machine.
Yes.
It's just really silly.
Anyway, so yes, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yes, it is very silly.
What else you got?
I was looking for the big red button because when the head of the lab or the head of the center turns up and his production line for these headsets is on fire and, you know, all his incredible complex machine is going wrong and he's like, turn it off, we can't, he's in the system and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, what about the big red button, you know, and then all the power goes out, which is what you'd really have. What else? Let me just have a quick look at...
And when he eventually does watch the thing all the way through to the end, he's in a random phone box.
Yes. Okay, so this is where... This is the section in my notes called Death Tape.
Oh, you want to do the Death Tape?
Yeah.
Much like the last Christopher Walken film we watched, there was, in the middle of this, you know, fairly reasonable film, suddenly a few frames of incredible unpleasantness.
Oh, yeah.
With all the limbs and the intestines in hell.
Yeah. So for some reason, when you are dying, you see weird wibbly patterns and you see the outside.
Memories from your previous existence.
You see a galaxy from the outside. You briefly see horrible patterns of hell.
Yes. And then angels.
And then the main thing that I remember from watching the film the last time, which is, oh, look at all the angels!
Yeah.
It's like...
I mean, really?
I mean, to be fair, they're not really angels. They're more like, I don't know, jellyfish or something. But
they're definitely wings.
But they're obviously... Yeah, but
winged figures of light.
Yes, I mean, that is obviously what they're supposed to be representing.
Yes.
But they're not close enough necessarily for you to be able to say, oh, that's a Judeo-Christian representation of blah, 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 blah.
No.
But they're flappy light beings of some variety.
Yes.
Who are heading off to some point in the distance. And so it's not like, you know, we're leaving the door open to interpretation of what's going on here. It's
no.
like, oh, look, the afterlife. So, yes. And then Christopher Walken dies. Except he doesn't die, he comes back to life.
Well, no, there wasn't any suggestion that he was dead.
Well, so his wife has turned up and found him at this place that they used to go to. And she thought that him watching the tape had killed him off. And then he's like...
She calls him back because he promised not to leave her again.
Something like that. Yes. Yes.
And then they kiss and it's all over.
Thank God.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes. And I'm not sure I really have anything else. So, briefly, I just found it really amusing that the music was either non-existent or very kind of subdued, except for any moment when they're either talking about or engaging in crime. And then it kind of gets really upbeat and jaunty and exciting.
Okay.
And it was just like, you can tell when the crime's happening because the music starts becoming jolly. And it was just
fair enough.
Really weird. And I think I am done before the diversity.
Okay.
What do you have?
Well, for 1983, I have to say it wasn't that bad because Lillian is very much the driver of the science project.
Yes.
Karen is very much an equal partner in getting hold of the tape and doing all of the do with distracting the company and setting up the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Hal's wife also helps with shutting the power down.
Oh, is that who it is?
Yeah.
Oh.
So, you know, it's not so bad. But then you've also got the bikini babes in the water slide and the hostesses offering the cake and the sorry ladies from the demo guy.
And when the...
And the sex tape, obviously.
And when the investors turn up, it was notable to me that all the men got firm handshakes and the woman got a kiss on the cheek.
Yes, I noticed that as well. Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the, you know, in the meeting when Lillian throws the hissy fit, oh, she's just a hysterical woman. We will ignore everything that she says and does.
There's also the bit where there's a party at one point where Michael, where Michael turns up with
Karen.
No, Michael turns up
with Lillian.
With Lillian, and Karen turns up with
someone else,
unnamed
random guy.
Unnamed random guy that she's apparently been seeing, who is then never seen again.
Yeah.
And somebody comes up to her and doesn't say, "It's very impressive this work you're doing on this incredible machine that's going to change the world," but instead says,
"Oh, it must be so great being married to this guy."
Yes.
Yes, I noticed that as well. Which is why I was still so confused, because that was before I'd realised that she was the same person. Because at the party, he'd been making some joke about the guy she was with,
yeah.
And then someone came up and made some comment about them being married, and I was like, huh?
What? Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's never explained.
Never explained. Some good things, some not so good things.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of ethnicity, there are two black security guards, one of whom does have lines, and one Asian lab worker, but other than that, it's 100%
white.
There is
a black chef right at the start who prepares the food that Gordo tastes, and he is very stereotypical black guy.
True. Yeah. And he's in it. Yeah.
And also, really, really, really weirdly, even for this film, when Michael goes back to his house some point early on, when it appears that Karen is living there with unnamed guy who's never seen again, when he turns up at the house, there is a string quartet playing in the house. Like,
yeah, but I mean, Karen is a music person of some variety.
Okay.
And their son is playing with them as well. And they've got friends around who are also doing some kind of music thing.
Yeah. One of the people that's playing is, only bring it up, because one of the people who's playing has his back to the camera.
Right.
And he is black.
Okay.
And he absolutely, definitely does not know how to play the instrument that he's pretending to play. Because he is waving it around in some way that is not akin to what you do with a violin.
Fair enough.
So there's not many non-white characters in it, and those that are in it don't come off particularly well.
No, this is true. Because one of them is one of the comedy security guys who falls down and gets chased around by the robots a lot.
But, on the other hand...
Robots. Yes, many, many robots.
Quite a lot of
who
robots.
Are quite important.
So, robots, yes, but no. But there are a bunch of robot arms, but there's no, like, robots you can talk to.
No.
So I was slightly sad.
Yeah.
But
they do get a Benny Hill moment.
They do get a Benny Hill moment, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm done. So, that does about wrap it up for the show. Regular listeners will know that we have a 5-star rating system with half stars allowed.
2.
Yeah, I think I would also go 2. I think the concepts are really interesting. I kind of like the idea that it starts off being a machine that does real-time transmission of sensoria, but then evolves into being something that allows you to access memories and other stuff. I think that's a really interesting evolution. And then the plot device of somebody dying and using that to find out, you know, whether there's an afterlife. I think if you wrote that into a kind of, you know, 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, amazing science fiction type short story, I think I'd be all over that. I think that's a really good thing. Not executed very well as a film at all, sadly. So yeah, I think 2 is about right.
Okay. So you didn't really still love it?
Not really, no.
Oh, well.
Oh, dear. And now, Revenge?
Well, maybe, maybe not. So I'm going very different.
Right.
I don't really know why this is on the list, but I saw it on the list and I thought, that's kind of what I'm in the mood for. So I'm going to go with Man on Fire, Denzel Washington.
Oh. Denzel Washington, one of the, you know, century's best actors.
Yeah.
Is it a police-ish?
He's a bodyguard, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, I might be thinking of Training Day.
Yes, that is the other one.
Okay.
That was considered, but I think I want to go with Man on Fire.
I think I've seen Training Day. I don't think I've seen Man on Fire. Okay.
Well, I went to see it in the cinema on my own, so who knows why that happened.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's my choice. And that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo, as ever, for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And as always, if you have any comments or would like to tell us about a time when you shared some media that you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can always email us at willyoustillloveit@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And also, you can buy our merch at http://bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast with hyphens where the spaces would be.
So please join us next month to find out what Dave thinks of Man on Fire.
And whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.